Thank you, Jeff, too. And I'm really hoping that by the end of today that we'll have some time for questions and comments and some discussion around this, because I think that that's the important part. So I'm hoping to present just enough content here to generate some of that. And my plan for today is really to introduce you to three people who have, or a few people I would say, that have helped me make the shift from thinking about those people versus our people. And so first I'm going to start with just giving you a little bit of a picture of who I am and where I'm coming from, because I think that perhaps that could help bridge a gap, if you sense that there might be one, from where you're sitting today and what it is that Jeff was describing last week that goes on at Hot Middle Bridge Faith Community. So to start with, I'll just say, you know, my husband and I have been married for 34 years, and we've led really a very conventional life. We have two children who are both married now. They're both educated, both working, enjoying life. We've been longtime members and elders of Glenshaw Presbyterian Church, which is a church that's really very more similar to Westminster than it is to Hot Metal. You know, it's in a suburban setting. We're on a smaller campus, but architecturally, our buildings are similar. The members of our congregation, for the most part, have sufficient resources. And I would say among our membership, there's a real respect and honoring of propriety that goes on within that congregation. And I say that because maybe the picture Jeff painted last week could have looked like something you couldn't relate to as much with the people coming in off the street and talking about severe mental illness. And that might be a concern to some of you about what does that look like. So I'm just want to say that rest assured that your context and Glenshaw's is probably always going to look different from Hot Metal's. Yet we all need to be aware of preconceived notions we have and be open to what God might be calling us to do and be as unique and faithful expressions of church. And so in addition to all of that, I will just say, let me grab my pencil here, that my life, you know, as I described, you know, I've had a good life. And I reached a point in my life where I just wasn't content. And the lack of contentment wasn't really based on the trajectory of my life, but it was the fact that I was kind of blindly following this path that had been set before me. And I just started asking a lot of questions around, you know, why am I doing what I'm doing? And why does the church doing what it does? And what is the Christian life really all about? I just had a sense that there was something more there. And so I started meeting with a spiritual director and felt called at that point to leave my job as an elementary school teacher. That was my first vocation. Spent a season of prayer and discernment, which was wonderful. It just fed this deep hunger in me, and it increased a longing in me for this different kind of faithfulness. With that, I entered into the Spiritual Formation Certificate Program at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. That led me to a Ministry of Spiritual Direction program, which then ultimately led me to working on my master's in counseling. So I entered into that master's program in 2005 because I just thought, I cannot possibly understand someone's spiritual life without knowing more about their emotional and mental health and life. It just seemed to me there had to be an impact on what a person's image of God was going to be, what that relationship with God was going to be. So that was the point where I, too, showed up on Hetz's doorstep, like Jeff shared, because in my counseling program, the faculty said, you know, if you have never been in therapy or in counseling, that is something you really need to do, because A, you need to know what it's like to be on the other side of the room, and B, we all have stories that we need to learn to tell and to know what our issues, if you will, are. And so I have to say that I heard that not as a strong suggestion, but as a mandate. And I was really very excited about the opportunity. And I think this is where it goes back to this culture of propriety, perhaps, in which I grew up, because I finally had an excuse to go into therapy, to go see a counselor that was acceptable here. That, you know, because in the circles that I traveled in, there was a stigma or some shame, it seemed like, and maybe some unspoken judgment about weakness somehow that was associated with being the recipient of mental health services. And in my circles, the theological understanding of brokenness seemed to be more intellectual than it was deep within, a sense of what that was, and that mental health was not something that was known to need care, like our physical health needs diet and exercise. We thought mental health, just you either had it or you didn't. And if you didn't have it, then you were mentally ill, which meant, you know, you were unstable and not to be respected and all of those things, which is really just ridiculous when I think about it. It's like saying that I am totally well unless I have stage 4 cancer. And in fact, there's an agency now that it calls themselves, a mental health advocacy agency that is called Before Stage 4, helping people to recognize the early, you know, how do you know you have a cold? You have a runny nose, right? Well, what is the mental health equivalent of having a cold or having some other kind of health? So it's about helping people to understand that. So I suspect, you know, that some of it was ignorance and some of it was pride and some of it was fear, you know, that played a significant role in that thinking in which I was kind of immersed in. But the opportunity was really the beginning of a shift for me in owning my mental health story, and that led to a greater capacity in me for compassion and empathy, and it created a shift from those people to our people. So we all have a mental health story to tell. And so I want you to think today about what I'm going to say from two different perspectives. One from an outreach perspective. You know, are you, or is this congregation in some way being called to more actively reach out to be of service to people who struggle with mental illness? Or within this congregation, in-house, what are the norms within this congregation? Could God be inviting you to shift the culture a little bit, to be more hospitable toward mental illness? And when I say hospitable, I don't just mean polite. You know, how can we create an environment where it is not us and them, but it's all of us, our people? So here are the three people I want to introduce you today who I deem to be trustworthy guides. And I'm sure you recognize at least one of them, right? Okay. So each of them has inspired me to engage with people more honestly, to do my part to create safe spaces for people to tell their stories. And they have cast a vision for me of what it is that I believe I'm praying for when I say, "Thy kingdom come." So the first here is Brené Brown. Any of you recognize Brené? Are you familiar with her work? Yeah. So she is a researcher professor at the University of Houston in the School of Social Work. And her areas of study, as you see, are courage, vulnerability, empathy, and shame. And she has taken the country by storm. Thanks be to God, I will say. Because she In 2011 was when she kind of became a house, started to move into households, when she did a TED Talk that was called The Power of Vulnerability. It went viral overnight, and it's been interesting to watch her over these last 6 years, because initially she spoke from her researcher perspective, you know, reporting the data. Here's what I am finding helps people to connect and to be well mentally. And in recent years, she's become more public about her faith. She was raised, initially she was baptized in the Episcopal Church, and then through a series of events ended up becoming a series of unintentional events, which is a fun story, but anyway, ended up becoming Catholic, Roman Catholic, left the church for a while, and is now very active again in the Episcopal Church. And in fact, in January, she was asked to preach at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and has also recently made a presentation at Riverside Church in New York. And she is really making connections between her research findings and what it is that Jesus was talking about in terms of how we are to be in relationship with one another. Brené says that loving ourselves through the process of owning our own story is the bravest thing we will ever do. And when I read that and hear that, I think about Luke 10:27. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Who ever thought of owning your story as a way of loving yourself? Or can we think about when we don't own our story, when we're ashamed of our story, when there are pieces of our story that we leave out, that that's a way of not loving ourselves? I think that's a really interesting thought. So Brené speaks a lot to our shared human need for acceptance and the lengths we are willing to go to find it. And she would say it's not a wound. We need to be accepted. That is who we are. That is what it means to be human. And she makes a interesting distinction between fitting in and belonging. Fitting in is about assessing a situation and becoming who you need to be accepted. Belonging, on the other hand, doesn't require us to change who we are. In fact, it requires us to be who we are. So fitting in is not necessarily about lying, about saying, oh yes, I'm a doctor, when you're really not, you know. But it is still dishonest, because it may not tell the whole story, which paints a different picture of who you are. And I like that belonging is not just being able to be yourself, but that it requires it. It requires it. So we have this sentiment expressed about fitting in and belonging has been expressed to us at this Kintsugi service at Hot Metal Bridge. Because what we have learned is that a question that for people who struggle with maintaining their mental health, that a question that is always in the forefront of their mind is, do I belong? Any situation they walk into, do I belong? Can I show up as I am? And we have learned through the feedback that we've gotten, despite our best efforts, that there is even still more we can do at Hot Metal in this Kintsugi service to answer that question immediately for people when they walk through the door. I think that's a good question, and I think it's something that unconsciously we probably all do when we walk into a room. Brené suggests that it is the job of churches to create safe places where people can can show up and be vulnerable. So here she links vulnerability with belonging. Because when we feel vulnerable when we risk the possibility of being rejected. And so do we want our churches to be places where people have to worry about protecting themselves? And I understand the value of calling forth the highest and the best part of a person. I mean, sometimes that's the greatest part of going to church, is we're reminded of that part of ourselves that is there. But I would say that is our truest self that we connect with there. And we don't want people to feel like they need to hide the less acceptable part, the part that they feel ashamed of, perhaps, just to fit in. Do we want our churches to be safe places for people to show up, experience healing through their sense of belonging? What is Christ's vision for his church? So last year, and I think it was at about this time, the Methodist church near here sponsored Mike Yukonski to come and speak. Does anyone know what I'm talking about here? Mike, he kind of did his own study of spending a year of living as a homeless person in six different cities around the country. And then he wrote a book afterwards called Under the Overpass. And he said that the hardest thing about being homeless was to feel dehumanized. And so this idea of being dehumanized keeps emerging here. How do we dehumanize people? We certainly don't do it consciously, right? But Brené says, if your opinion involves the dehumanization of me, I can't risk my physical and emotional safety to be vulnerable with you. So if your opinion involves the dehumanization, and what is she talking about here? Well, I think she is talking about racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, all of these types of attitudes that we might keep to ourselves. We might not speak these attitudes, but they leak out and they create an environment that does not feel safe for somebody whose antenna is up all of the time asking that question, do I belong here? And she says that actually creates trauma. And so it's interesting because, you know, at least for me, before I was in this field, I thought of trauma as events. You know, it might be you're a victim of a violent crime or you are a victim of a natural disaster and that creates trauma in you. But she says it's like swimming in toxic water, the toxic water being that place where you don't feel like you belong, and that creates a condition of trauma, and that the greatest casualty of trauma is vulnerability, that we're not able to be vulnerable when we've experienced some of that. So what are the things that I take away from Brené in terms of moving from those people to our people? I take away the idea of vulnerability, that it is a pearl of great price, and that we, to be a safe person, to be a safe church, that we need to own our stories, which means being vulnerable with one another. It means engaging in the stories of others and taking those interpersonal risks, and that our mental health is linked to our sense of belonging. And that those people become our people when we are in touch with our full humanity. So the next person I want to introduce you to is Greg Boyle, Father Greg Boyle. Am I familiar with him? Got a few, yeah. So Greg, we're on a first name basis here, and all these friends of mine. Greg is he's an American Jesuit priest who lives in California, and he is best known for his work with rehabilitating gang members. He has a comprehensive program of mental health services, case management, education, job training, and yes, even tattoo removal is part of rehabilitating gang members. He says, removing the most hateful time of a person's life, the reminder of the most hateful time of a person's life. He says that his motto is that nothing stops a bullet like a job. But the jobs are not so readily available for recovering gang members because you need a lot of felony-friendly employers. And he said, since the demand exceeded the supply, he had to become one. And so he started this whole industry that is called Homeboy Industries. And under that umbrella is Homeboy silk screening, printing, homegirl and homeboy cafes and bakeries, a number of businesses that employ these gang members who are being rehabilitated. Greg says that gang violence is about a lethal absence of hope, that nobody has ever met a hopeful kid who joined a gang. And so I know that we're not gathered here today to talk about gangs, but hopelessness is also a symptom of much mental illness, despair. And so hope is what the church is about, right? Not just in the hereafter, but in the now, here on earth. And so how can we offer a message of hope, not just with our words, but to be hope, to embody hope for others? And Greg encourages us to reorient our perspective. He suggests that we move from a model of service provider and service recipient to a model of kinship. Wow, that sounds a lot like what Jesus talked about, too, in terms of kinship. But I think, the language of service provider and service recipient can be just another way of holding people at a distance, of even wielding power, unconsciously, of course, or in dividing people into categories of us and them. And if you're not sure about that for yourself, think about which category you would rather be in. Would you be rather thought of as a service provider or a service recipient? Well, the answer for me was clearly I wanted to be the service provider because that's why I was going to be the counselor, because I couldn't be the service recipient. My culture wouldn't let me do that in a way that I could save face, right? So he says that the language of service provider and service recipient always easily makes it about doing for rather than being with, rather than being in relationship. So, which is so often not the intention at all of any of us. I mean, I really, truly believe that our intentions are good on the part of the service provider. But until we individually or as a church do our own work of telling our stories, of our whole stories, of being human and owning that, this is what is often conveyed. And so Greg says that people are not so much in need of services as they are in need of kinship and connection. And that kinship is about relationship. So one of the first things that I assess for as a counselor is support. Does this person have adequate support in their lives? Do they feel supported? Are they connected to others in a meaningful and life-giving way? Mental health deteriorates when there is inadequate support. And sometimes it's the disease that blocks a person's ability to take in the support, but it's important to remember that it's connection and kinship that ultimately heal people. And I think, as I think back to my own story, you know, when I started asking those questions of why am I doing what I'm doing? Why does the church do what it does? That at some level I felt inadequate support because I was surrounded by people who weren't asking that question. At least out loud they weren't asking that question. And so that was where HETS came in particularly helpful for me. So Greg wrote this book, Tattoos on the Heart, which I highly recommend if you're looking for something to read. And I don't want to suggest that services aren't important, because they are. People benefit from services a lot. But he says that the services are just the hallway to the ballroom. And the ballroom is where kinship and connection happen. I love that. And so what does Father Greg have to say to me about moving from those people to our people? He says that us and them is a false dichotomy. It's all us. We are all interconnected. And that service is a means to an end. But that we are the ones that end up changed by providing the service, or can be, if we put ourselves in that place where grace can happen. And those people become our people when we recognize our kinship. And now for the person that we all know really well, I'm sure. He needs no introduction. And his face alone, this picture, I'm sure, conveys safety and belonging and kinship and connection to you just by looking at his face, right? And he says, Fred Rogers says, anything that is human is mentionable. And anything that is mentionable can be more manageable. When we talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming, less upsetting, less scary. The people we trust with that important talk can help us know that we are not alone. So thinking back to Mike Yukonski and his book, Under the Overpass, and his experience of homelessness and dehumanization as one of the worst parts of homelessness, I think of Jesus and how well Jesus rehumanized people by his presence, by making anything that was mentionable, anything that was human, mentionable here. So as I read this quote, I wonder how much we even dehumanize ourselves and others through our social norms of what is acceptable to talk about. And how can we be a presence of rehumanizing that leads to greater health? Fred says that knowing that we can be loved exactly as we are gives us all the best opportunity for growing into the healthiest of people. Healthy in mind, body, spirit. And that love isn't a state of perfect caring. It's an active noun, like struggle. To love someone is to strive to accept that person exactly the way he or she is, right here and now. And I would say that applies not just to loving others, that applies to loving ourselves as well. To love ourselves is to strive to accept ourselves exactly the way we are, right here and now. So what are my takeaways from Mr. Rogers? Moving from those people to our people, I think he says we need community and support. We need to be neighbors, right? He was all about being neighbors. And that our health depends on love and belonging. And not to judge. Get curious about people. Just get curious. And that those people become our people when we recognize our own belovedness. So owning our stories and telling them is important to our mental health, for ourselves and for others. We need to create environments that are safe to encourage a willingness to be vulnerable. And someone's got to take the risk first. And when we do this, those people become our people. So in conclusion here, to wrap up, I want to share a story with you from this book, The Remarkable Ordinary by Frederick Buechner. Anyone read Buechner's stuff? I would think, yeah. I know Hetz is a big fan of Frederick Buechner, and he has introduced him to me. And so let me just share a story here and a couple of talking points from this story to kind of pull things together. So he's telling a story about how he went into, he lived outside of New York City, but he went into the city one evening to have dinner with his mother because he had not seen his mother in quite a while. And he said, I hadn't seen her for a while. And she'd sort of gotten things all pulled together. The apartment looked nice, and she had cooked a nice little meal and had the silver candlesticks on the table. We were just about to sit down for supper when the phone rang. It was for me, which was surprising, as it was her apartment. And it was a friend of mine with whom I had taught a few years ago. And almost immediately, I heard to my horror that he was in tears. It scared me out of my wits, because how do you ever deal with somebody's tears? Especially somebody I had no reason to think had cause for tears. He was calling because there had been a terrible automobile accident on the West Coast in which his mother, his father, and his pregnant sister had all been involved, and he wasn't sure that any of them would live. He was flying out to see what he could do, if there was anything to do. He was at the airport, and he asked, could I come and just sit with him until the plane took off? Instead of saying yes, just like that, which any normal person would have done, he suggests, thinking of my mother in the other room and this meal that she'd prepared, I said, will you call back in 5 minutes? I've just got to go talk to my mother. So I went back and I told her this story, and her reaction was absolutely ridiculous. He's a grown man. He's behaving like a child. I've got this wonderful dinner prepared, and we haven't seen each other in a long time. He'll be perfectly all right. And what was so horrifying about it was not just that she said it, but that I'd already said it to myself. It was a real watershed. I'd said all those things to myself. How absurd. Then this revelation that not to go into the world's pain, not to go see my friend, not to somehow offer him whatever cup of cold water I could, to play it safe, to stay with my mother, to have a nice dinner, was not only for the world's sake a disaster, but for my sake a disaster. To play it safe, to stay home where the candles are lit and the meal is prepared, was to have your life somehow diminished. To go out into the world, even if the world scares the hell out of you and bores you to death and intimidates you and confuses you, that is the only life. Somehow I saw that, I felt that, knew it through that moment. When the phone rang again, he said, don't come down. My plane is leaving in 20 minutes. I'm off. It's just good to talk to you. And so the moment passed, and no harm was done, I think, but great good was also done. And so the point of that story is not that we should be available 24/7 to every request that comes our way, or to forsake our families for the needs of others. But there are three points that stand out to me with regard to our topic for today, about moving from those people to our people. And the first is the comment, he's a grown man. He's behaving like a child. I've got this wonderful dinner prepared, and we haven't seen each other in a long time. There is a childishness and an ugliness and an unwillingness within us all, and we often project it onto others, which is what Buechner became aware of in that moment that he was having uncharitable thoughts, too, about his friend, that he had not recognized them until his mother spoke them out loud. And the grace is that he was able to own those in that moment, to be honest with himself about that in that moment. And he also, most likely, turned to his mother with that request, knowing that she would frown upon it, which would give him the excuse that he wanted to not be in the midst of all of that pain where he didn't know how to fix it. And so I think a key here is that connection happens not only when we can say yes, but perhaps even more so when we can talk within community openly about our resistance and that the connection heals that isolation in which that mental illness can grow. A connection for him to talk in community. His reading audience is his community, but for him to say that was a way of him connecting. The second point from that story that stands out to me is not to go into the world's pain, not to see my friend, not to somehow offer him whatever cup of cold water I could, to play it safe, to stay with my mother, to have a nice dinner, was not only for the world's sake a disaster, but for my sake a disaster. So just at a kind of a surface level, I'll share that the desert monastics from back in the 3rd and 4th century, they used to always caution us against whatever that movement of the heart was that kept us from giving a cup of cold water to one person just because we couldn't solve the whole bigger problem. You know, like the church that can only feed, you know, only has room to provide a meal for 25 people won't do that because, well, that doesn't solve the world's problem of people being hungry. But he says that Buechner said that the situation he found himself in that day was not only for the world's sake a disaster, but for his sake a disaster. Unresponsiveness to pain is a disaster for those who are suffering. But how does it become a disaster for us as well? Well, not just because of the far-reaching ripple effects of untreated pain that turns into violence and crime and addiction and homelessness and suicide and despair. But it's a disaster for us because we've missed the opportunity to be changed. Direct exposure to the pain of others puts us in the place where grace can happen. And it can change us. It can change our hearts. Our hearts of stone can become hearts of flesh. When those people have names and stories, and they become our people because we're in relationship. And so that reminds me of this passage from Ezekiel. A new heart I will give you, a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove your body from your body, the heart of stone, and give you a heart of flesh. And then finally, this sentence, and so the moment passed, and no harm was done, I think, but great good was also done. The great good was done within him. He was forever changed by those awarenesses that he had. And there was a moment of honest reckoning that he had with himself, which opened him to seeing the choices he was making, and that was liberating for him. Doesn't mean he's never going to have dinner with his mother. Having dinner with your mother is an important thing as well. But I'm just saying, you as an individual or collectively as a church may be being called to enter the hallway to the ballroom where kinship and connection happen, to be of service to those on the margins who struggle with profound mental illness and those who are part of communities like Hot Metal, or not. Maybe in a different kind of community. But regardless, I think as churches, we're called to provide safe and sacred spaces for each other, to create spaces of belonging, spaces that require us to show up as we are with our gifts, which usually come out of our brokenness, and to be those people who see brokenness as a given, as not something to be hidden, but as part of our beauty, which is the philosophy behind the kintsugi artwork here. So tonight we have a kintsugi worship service at Hot Metal Bridge. I invite you to come if you would like to. The service begins at 7 o'clock. There's Sacred Space, which is a contemplative practice group that meets before that, that I'll be leading, is at 6 o'clock. Come check it out if you would like to see what it's all about. So, anyway, thank you for listening. And we have a few minutes, I think, if you have questions or comments, that things that were sparked in you. Yeah, okay, good. All right. What does this leave for you? What are you thinking about right now?
Thank you. This is so wonderful. I think you brought up so many resources, Lynn. And as I hear each of those references, I'm like, oh, I know about all those people, but I didn't get that book exactly. So it's in my mind is spurring me to want to further look into each of those.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Mm-hmm.
Your last
anecdote from Buechner? Frederick Buechner?
I'm going to take that and think about it too, because I would want to know, was that the first time that she had seen him be called away on somebody's will of the wisp, or was it the thousandth time? And finally she couldn't take it anymore and said, listen, you know, I'm here too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same person is here. And if you always go over for somebody, if you always leave for somebody.
Right. And you know, and we don't know that part of the story, right? And I think the reason we don't know it is because I don't think it's that it's relevant to what his awarenesses were. I think the key was of what he became aware of in himself, of these movements and this tendency not to just be, you know, of his own resistance, his own reluctance, his own tendency to blame others or to project it out onto other people. You know, all we know is that the end of the day, he did have dinner with his mother because his friend ended up flying off before he got to the airport, and that was, you know, that was good. We don't know where she was coming from or what the whole picture was, but I think that the important piece was what he became aware of in himself.
Mm-hmm. And, my husband and I were on a trip where we walked a lot. Mm-hmm. So we walked constantly in the city of Dublin through past beggars. And it really started to tug at me. There were young people and older people and people that looked like they just spent their last anything on a drink and they wanted another drink, so they were begging. And we happened to be staying, and my husband is adamant about not giving to beggars because you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But we were staying at a place, at the convent of the Sisters of Mercy, and there was a big statue of Mother Macaulay out front, and then on the inside of the convent was a piece that said, better to take in 100 undeserving poor than turn away one deserving. So my husband and I talked about that a lot. We had these talks about the other, mostly in terms of financial of beggars, not so much in mental health. But he is of that mind that he'll say, I'm sure those don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, they're...
people who think that, you know, like, and you talk about your own culture.
Yeah, right. To think that we know, and you know, those are tough questions. But if I can risk, maybe I'm not putting you on the spot, but mentioning Nana here, who is here with us, that Nana and I actually are involved in a ministry where we go into the jail, And we are confronted with these social norms a lot, you know, about the culture from which we come from, about what we talk about and what we don't talk about. And these men that we meet with a small group of men, usually 6 or 7 or up to 10 men that we meet with each week. And, you know, desperation and breaks through a lot of what those norms are, you know. And so, you know, we are constantly kind of challenging each other about what kept us from asking that next question. Or, you know, why, you know, they're willing to talk. They want to talk about this stuff. What is our, you know, what are the barriers within us that keep us from doing that? Mm-hmm. Also, another thought I had, like last night when it was, you know, way too late to change what I was going to talk about today, but I realized, you know, I worked for about 6 or 7 years as a drug and alcohol counselor, and I thought, you know, there was an experience of moving from those people to our people, you know, and really recognizing and thinking, I want what they have got without having to go through the humiliation and the desperation, and because of their ability to just be so vulnerable, so willing, you know, not putting themselves in the position of deciding who's deserving and who's not deserving. You know, I'm not sure that that's our job. I don't know. It's tough questions. Yeah.
I think one thing religious people struggle with is salvation for everybody, or just a chosen few? Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. However, it's a problem. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, the most helpful, simple definition of salvation that I have come across
is healing,
right? The idea that the word salve is ointment that we put on wounds, and it's about healing. And so, you know, are we called to move toward healing and greater wholeness? I would say that is a universal call, you know, for us all to move toward health and well-being.
The medical profession only treats people with diseases. Mm-hmm. Mental health profession only treats people with clear mental illness, like hallucinations and things like mm-hmm. that. But, you know, mental health is along the spectrum. We're all on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there's this dividing line. If you get over that dividing line, it's a disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've struggled with that as a professional because I've never felt like I work from a medical model where there's diagnosis and, you know, pathology. I tend to work more from what I think of as a model of personal growth or a developmental model, and thinking that sometimes it's this arrested development that happens that creates this situation. And so it's about removing those barriers so that we can move in the trajectory that we are meant to move in, which is toward health and wholeness. And so you're right there. So there's the difference between so that's what it's been helpful for me as a counselor to think that, you know, I'm working with people to prevent them from crossing over whatever that line is in the mental illness. The psychiatric, I guess, is the term there for the real pathology. You know, but then we get into the healthcare system and needing, if people are going to use their insurance, needing to provide a diagnosis and all of that. So there's some improvement in the system that needs to take place. Some changes, I would say. Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about, I've been doing a lot of reading about mass incarceration and how mental health intersects with that. Thinking about cause and effect, and, you know, I go round and round on that myself. But I have a bit of a picture of what, you know, it must be like, especially for black males. Well, I think more than I mean, I was grown. This is complicated, so forgive me. I was raised to be independent in a way that's almost logical, perhaps. But you know, mental health was treated.
treat it as snap, like it was kind of like
pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm struggling with here is you've got a culture and a demographic for whom they're clearly a disproportionate set of mental health issues compared to a well-off demographic who's doing okay, not in jail by any stretch of the imagination, and doing well financially. Is there a space for them to recognize that they also may be on this spectrum?
That's exactly what I'm talking about, Bob. That is exactly what I'm talking about. Yes. I mean, and that's what I'm encouraging, that places like Westminster and Glenshaw, you know, where people are, you know, they're educated and they've got adequate resource, you know, financially and all of that. But to be able to talk about that and to recognize, you know, that it's not shameful. Yeah.
I'm having a hard time picturing that. I've never attended. Is that law applicable in this environment, or is that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's what we've been doing this service for almost, this is our third year, I think, for doing it. And we just recently met with someone who, you know, who attends the service regularly to get feedback from her. And what we took from that was that we needed to be clearer about who it is that we're trying to draw into this service. Because we were trying to draw in, we thought we were trying to draw in the people who, you know, really do struggle with some chronic mental illness, the severe, you know, I mean, at that one end of the continuum. But what we were drawing was people at this other end that were, you know, because our tagline for the service was for better mental health. So it suggested that there was mental health, we just wanted to improve it. And so we're working at trying to figure out how do we rework it so that we do attract a population that struggles more. So in answer to your question, yes, I do think that it is a model and a service that could happen here. And, you know, it may be a different population. That, you know, it might be a service for better mental health. Yeah.
I had a severe depression at age 27, so I know well of what you speak. Three of us gave a seminar on depression in the mid-1980s. And to me, the wonderful part about it is that each week it was better attended. And what I came to understand is that people were struggling, not, John, as you said, on the line of a diagnosis, but on this wide spectrum. And they clearly were interested in the topic. A number of people told me, I've been experiencing this for a long time. I've told no one. I'm alone. I'm interested in learning about it. And I guess my point is that even at a place like this, back in the 80s, this was well received.
Wonderful.
We never did anything with it in terms of ongoing, but that was a little, you know, 4-week example.
Yeah.
That it's possible.
And how many years have passed since then? You know, but to create a culture where that is kind of a part of a regular conversation, it sounds like people were drawn in.
Yeah, they did not.
Because they felt like they could belong. I can talk about this here, or at least I'm in the company of people who are acknowledging it. Brené Brown talks about these three phases, the reckoning, the rumbling, and the revolution. And she says, we might acknowledge something, and we jump to the, you know, and she says, we'll skate right over the rumbling and say, you know, it was a street fight, and then now it's all good, you know. But the, you know, yeah, I had trouble, it was a street fight, and now it's all good. And she says, it's in that rumbling, it's in the talking about the experience of the depression and giving the hope then, you know, as people have moved through it or on it, but that we need to, the connection happens when we do more talking about the rumbling of the hard work of being in the midst of it. That's great. I'm glad to hear that Westminster has done that and encourage you to do that more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nana.
I just want to mention that we do have two small groups here that are all about recognizing our vulnerability and being in a safe place to heal. Mm-hmm. At the end of the spectrum that we all are on, and that's the centering prayer practice and the Enneagram practice.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those do exactly that, make us aware of where those vulnerabilities are and the ability to own up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And to love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a good reminder. I actually came and participated in the Enneagram workshop that was here, and it was great. And I would add that this idea of vulnerability, that we can tell people things about ourselves, and maybe this is a starting place that is new for us. You know, we can tell it, but we can tell it in a way that's very guarded. You know, it's kind of like, you know, yeah, this is how I am. To me, the vulnerability piece is when you can feel it in your gut and you feel like you're taking a risk by saying something that's true about yourself. You know, and granted, I mean, context and all of that is important. But to me, that vulnerability and that risk can be felt at a gut level of I'm showing you who I am. And it's not finished. It's unfinished business for me.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I love that image. That's when our brokenness becomes gold.
It becomes golden, and it's not something to be hidden. It becomes part of the beauty of the object. It made it more interesting, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Good. All right. Yeah,
There is a current day example in Westminster. I'm sure there's many, but one is a men's group that meets Tuesday mornings, and it's all about vulnerability.
Yeah.
There's between 15 and 20 men, and they spend an hour
talking
not as much about mental health, but about their weaknesses, about their issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it draws people in.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be explicitly mental health, but that is what's happening when we're talking about the ways in which we don't feel like we're measuring up, or the ways in which we, you know, feel like we've disappointed someone, or whatever the case is. Yeah, good. Bob?
I was thinking about the same word that Dan mentioned, that there's small groups within the church, there's a level of trust.
Yeah.
You know, it builds up, and that lends to people to, you know, to be more vulnerable. But that's something that doesn't, at least in my experience, doesn't necessarily scale.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes time to build that trust. So mm-hmm. Do you find that in this consulting service, you know, new people come in, do they take that in a while?
Well, some people, but I think it depends on how desperate you are. Yeah, and I think that's a prudent question, you know, always to ask that, you know, how trustworthy is this? Trust is another topic that Brené talks a lot about, you know. So, good. You know, let me close us here with a blessing, and then I'll be available if anybody has questions or things they want to talk about afterwards. But thank you for your attention and for your ponderings today. May the light of God illumine the heart of your soul. May the flame of Christ kindle you to love. May the fire of the Spirit free you to live this day, tonight, and forever. Amen. All right, thank you.